Now, a story from our Baghdad bureau about Nunu, a refugee from Sadr City that our staff took in. Nunu is a white terrier. And like many impulsive pet adoptions, our human staff didn't anticipate all the problems that dog ownership can bring. NPR's Katia Dunn reports.
A few months after Nunu came to live with us in Baghdad, I asked Ghassan, an NPR translator, to call a veterinarian and make an appointment. We needed to have Nunu neutered. Ghassan didn't have any idea what I was talking about. I explained that in the States, when we own a dog, we think it's responsible to stop it from reproducing. We even call it fixing. In Iraq, Ghassan explained, it is just the opposite.
The idea of having a dog is to have puppies, and especially if that you may give one of the puppies to your close friends, your relatives. But right now, we're going backwards. Instead of having more puppies, we're trying to stop the coming puppies, which is a kind of nonsense.
Come here, baby. Here it is. Here's the ball.
Okay. It was Lourdes Garcia Navarro and I who decided we had to neuter Nunu. Garcia Navarro is a correspondent in Baghdad. Nunu kept getting lost, slipping out to gallivant around with the pack of stray females who roam the street outside our bureau. The snip, as she called it, seemed like the only solution.
Nunu, goodbye, Nunu.
On the day of Nunu's appointment, I tried to slip out the door quietly with him, but the staff caught me on the way out. Everyone is sad about Nunu, Ghassan said to me. He explained that for Iraqis, having a big family is a great achievement, a basic right of which we shouldn't deprive man or dog. Another translator, Isra, went so far as to say that Nunu would be scorned. Before this, she said, she always thought that the stray dogs outside envied Nunu for his posh indoor lifestyle.
But now, I mean, that he will stop being a male dog. I think no stray dog will ever think of envying him anymore.
I assumed the vet we visited would, like U.S. vets, be an advocate of population control. But this is the first thing veterinarian Leith Jacob Sabah said to me.
Yeah, it's a season of breeding. I prefer to find him a girlfriend. What do you think?
Sabah explained that veterinarians in Iraq are basically matchmakers. He proudly told us about hundreds of arranged dog marriages. He'd even brokered a few international unions. But I insisted, Sabah shrugged, and started shaving Nunu's fur. Ghassan and I stood by and whispered as we watched Sabah and his assistant do the surgery.
I think from now on he's going to be fat, because he will focus on eating. It's the only desire that left for him.
When we brought Nunu home later that day, I admit he looked pathetic, all bandaged up. Isra and Nada, two translators, were horrified.
I think so.
There is no other solution. Just an operation. It's awful.
You should give him asylum in the United States because he doesn't fit here anymore.
Today, Nunu has pretty much recovered. We're glad we don't have to worry about little baby Nunus showing up on our doorstep. The staff seems to have moved on. But did we do the right thing? I asked Garcia Navarro what she thought.
I think it's one of the things that you grapple with here all the time, whether you're imposing your own system on an alien culture, on a different way of doing things.
Of course, no single one of us can say for sure whether or not it was a good decision, except for maybe one dog. Katia Dunn, NPR News.
It's time for Three Books, our reading series where writers talk about three books on a single theme. Today's topic, teens who hate to read. 17-year-old Amber Gibson writes book reviews for the website teensread2.com, and she picked three stories that might get young people to crack a book and sit still for a couple of hours.
Competing with amusement parks, television, and Nintendo Wii, reading is not often a top priority for teens. Enticing us to read during the one time of year when we are not locked up in school is a daunting task. However, here are a few books that can steal even the most reluctant readers away from Guitar Hero, if only for a few hours. For girls who love Cosmopolitan, I recommend Melissa Walker's Violet on the Runway. Violet is transformed from awkward teenager to high-fashion diva almost overnight when she is unexpectedly discovered. Walker uses her insider experience as a fashion writer for magazines like Teen Vogue to paint a realistic portrait of the fashion industry. Not only a great escapist read for a day at the beach, Violet on the Runway is endearing and empowering as well. Think America's Next Top Model in book form, only better. For those with testosterone and a great sense of humor, Spud will induce many a smirk. South Africa in 1990 might be foreign to American teens that have never heard of apartheid. But 13-year-old John Milton and the rowdy boys at boarding school make for an unforgettable cast of characters. Read the book and discover the crude origins of John's nickname, Spud. Spud's diary entries are silly but occasionally insightful, like catching up with an old friend who has gone off to college and come back with outrageous stories that you can't quite believe. Spud's honest and often politically incorrect thoughts are refreshing and laugh-out-loud funny. Males and females alike will appreciate Jay Asher's 13 Reasons Why. This is the fictional story of a boy, Clay, dealing with the death of a girl he liked. Before she committed suicide, Hannah Baker left a series of cassette tapes behind, explaining the events that led Hannah to end her life. Depressing, yes, but teens know how brutal high school can be and will sympathize with Hannah and Clay. Asher shows how frighteningly interconnected our lives are and how much of an impact we can unknowingly have on others. 13 Reasons Why will leave you with chills long after you have finished reading. If you are a teen that hates to read, you'll be surprised by how much you enjoy these books. Maybe books will even replace TV as your primary form of entertainment. Nah, I doubt it.
Amber Gibson is 17 years old and lives outside Chicago. She reviews books for the website teensread2.com. You can find details on these three books and recommendations for many more on our website. Go to npr.org/books.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's getting harder to understand the world economy without understanding two of the world's most rapidly growing economic powers. China and India share a border. They share astonishingly rapid growth rates, and the two countries together are the subject of a crop of new books that Vishakha Desai has been reading. She is president of the Asia Society in New York, and she's going to help us review these books. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Let's start with a book here on the stack that is maybe the one with the title that's most likely to give an American heartburn, The New Asian Hemisphere, The Irresistible Shift of Global Power to the East.
That's by my friend Kishore Mahbubani, and it is very true that Mahbubani has been talking about this issue of rise of Asia for some time. But he has begun to talk about making sure that America particularly, but the West in general, recognizes that there is a shift underway.
He quotes some basic numbers here just to say who has a greater percentage of the world economy, and he argues that if you went back 2,000 years, you'd find that the overwhelming amount of economic activity was in Asia, and the vast majority has been in Asia, except for the last couple of centuries.
Well, for sure, Chinese often will tell you today, because they're very historically conscious, to say as late as 1600, 50% of world's GDP actually was in Asia. So last 250 years, some people might say, is just an exception.
Meaning that it would be natural to go back the other way?
Some Chinese have said that.
And does this book, The New Asian Hemisphere, present evidence suggesting that that is in fact what's happening now?
Well, let's put it this way. There will be a much larger percentage of the world's economic growth in Asia, particularly driven by China, India, but also Japan, Southeast Asia, etc. Kishore is perhaps too overly optimistic that it's all a foregone conclusion. I think that we have to recognize likelihood of America being a sole superpower is very, very small. But how America handles this and how Asia, especially China and India, handle their new global power status is also still a question that we have to deal with.
Well, let's move on to the next book on our stack here. And this is a stack of books, not just on China, not just on India, but on the pair together and the significance of them. The book is called Billions of Entrepreneurs.
Yes, this is by Tarun Khanna. His big message is to say that India and China are going to begin to have to work together more, that it is not simply that they can be seen as competitors, but they're going to have to be much more of collaborators, because what India does well, such as individual entrepreneurship without the interference from the state, versus what China does well, which has to do with state planning, macroeconomic planning to make things like infrastructure work, is something India really is going to have to do more of. And if India is the back office of the world, India is going to have to get more into other kinds of manufacturing, and China is going to have to do more of service economy.
So the books on our stack here are The New Asian Hemisphere, Billions of Entrepreneurs, and one more here, Bill Emmett's book, Rivals, How the Power Struggle Between China, India, and Japan Will Shape Our Next Decade.
I think it's very interesting, if you think about Bill Emmett, that that book is much more focused on political issues among these three countries. Khanna's book is much more focused on the economic advantage. And Mabubani, he's trying to pull together the economic and to some extent political together. You need to read all three books, first of all, because all of them are making an argument that you need to understand what's going on in Asia, and you need to understand the complexity of the situation, so that if you only look at the economic, you're not going to get it right. If you only look at the political, which is what Emmett does, you probably also will make some mistakes. I personally also add a third element, and that is that India and China are ancient civilizations. They are politically, let's say, 50, 60 years old, given their trajectory of the 20th century.
Just to clarify that communist China is 50, 60 years old, and India has had about 60 years since independence from Britain.
Exactly. And economically, you might say that India is an adolescent, about 16 years old, given economically the opening and what happened with the economy. China is about 30 years old. But culturally, these are more than 5,000-year-old civilizations. And in all of these countries, these three elements, how they come together is what we need to understand. So if Emmett talks about how mainly 20th century, but also even the last 200 years of histories of these countries suggest that they're going to be rivals, they're going to be looking at each other over their shoulder, there isn't a lot of trust, that we can't just keep moving on to this agenda that Asia is going to rise lock, stock, and barrel together. I think that there is some truth to that, but I think that you also have to recognize that intra-Asian trade today is among the fastest trading patterns in the world.
There's a lot of trade between China and India, say?
Today, China has now surpassed U.S. as India's largest trading partner.
Does that mean that the United States can feel comfortable, if that's the word, that China and India are going to effectively balance each other? There's not going to be a dominant player in Asia, and we don't have to worry about them so much.
Well, some people will say that indeed that's the case. Others have said, what if they come together? Because there is this assumption that when countries come together, somehow they're going to gang up on somebody else. There are two big phenomena out there. One is that the world is more interdependent than ever before. Number two, in that level of globalization is the rise of China and India and other parts of Asia. So we need to figure out the role we're going to play, not just to balance, but also as an active, responsible participant, so that we don't have to feel that we're the only ones who have all the answers, because that may not be the case.
The books are The New Asian Hemisphere, Billions of Entrepreneurs, and Rivals. They were all reviewed here by Vishakha Desai of the Asia Society. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And you can read excerpts from all three books at npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
You can expect gay and lesbian couples to line up this morning in county clerk offices across California to get marriage licenses. That's now legal because of the California Supreme Court's decision. San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom officiated at one of the first same-sex weddings last night. Two women in their 80s, icons of the gay rights movement, held a private ceremony at City Hall. From member station KQED in San Francisco, Sarah Varney has more.
Phyllis Lyon, 83, and Del Martin, 87, became a couple more than half a century ago and went on to start the first national group for lesbians. Last night, the elderly women married in a small ceremony in Mayor Newsom's office and then emerged to an adoring crowd. Newsom said presiding over the wedding ceremony is a great privilege.
I think today marriage as an institution has been strengthened. I think today marriage has been affirmed.
4 years ago, Newsom challenged the state's same-sex marriage ban and ordered city officials to marry gay couples. He asked Lyon and Martin to go first. The California Supreme Court later ruled that Newsom overstepped his authority. The court then invalidated Lyon and Martin's marriage license, along with 4,000 others. The same court, after considering the constitutionality of California's same-sex marriage ban, ruled that gay men and lesbians do have a constitutional right to marry, and that right took effect yesterday afternoon. Standing in front of a three-tiered wedding cake, Lyon rested her hands on the back of her wife's wheelchair and remembered when they met.
When we first got together, we weren't really thinking about getting married. We were just thinking about getting together.
And with that, the couple cut their wedding cake and left for a quiet reception with friends and family. Stuart Gaffney and his partner of 21 years, John Lewis, were on hand for the celebration. They'll be married this morning at San Francisco City Hall. Their families have flown in from the Midwest, New York, and Southern California, including Gaffney's parents, an interracial couple who wed after California legalized interracial marriage 6 decades ago.
Well, they're both going to be here with us in City Hall tomorrow, watching us exchange vows. And as we look at each other with love, we're going to see that love reflected back by our parents right there with us. Another generation in our family getting legally married. It's going to be a beautiful day.
Outside of City Hall, hundreds of supporters and some opponents of gay marriage gathered. Those protesting carried signs that said recriminalize sodomy and God hates lying sinners. Born-again Christian Bill Hampsmeyer traveled from the East Bay city of Fremont to demonstrate against the nuptial.
Oh, I think God is going to destroy this nation, not just this California. Look at all of our jobs. Our jobs are going overseas. God is judging this nation. It's going to get worse.
Helen Gould of Oakland, California, held a sign that read, "Married heteros support you."
I have so many friends who are so excited about getting married, and it's really way past time for married heteros to come forward and support their friends.
More than 650 same-sex couples have made appointments to get marriage licenses in San Francisco, and thousands more are expected to marry around the state in the coming weeks. It's not clear what will happen to those marriages if voters approve a constitutional amendment on the ballot in November that would ban gay marriage. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Varney in San Francisco.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Living on the shore has always been risky. Storms and hurricanes take their toll on beachfront houses. Well, now global warming is raising sea levels and threatening to move a shoreline inland. Consider the saga of one home on the Texas Gulf Coast. Independent producer David Barron has that story. It's part of the series we call Shifting Ground. Today, Battle Lines in the Sand.
Surfside, Texas. It's a small beach town south of Houston. No fancy condos here, no high-rise developments, just one traffic light, rows of cottages on tidy lawns, and at 809 Beach Drive, a house painted sky blue. A plastic sign displays its name.
The Sandcastle.
Brooks Porter and his wife Mary bought the Sandcastle a quarter century ago. They wanted a beach house that the family could use and that they could rent out for income.
We wanted a fixer-upper because that's what we could afford.
We were looking for a house that needed somebody to care about it.
And it was perfect.
In other words, it was a wreck, but you couldn't beat the location.
We had sand dunes and salt grasses growing in front of our house.
And just beyond, the beach. Since then, Surfside has seen some of the worst erosion on the Texas coast. The dunes are gone. So is the saltgrass. The house now sits at the water's edge, stranded like a beached whale. A whale on stilts, that is.
The house is up out of the ground by a good 10 feet.
This is a pretty unusual situation to be, have a house above and seashells and, well, some seaweed and the waves are right there.
Yes, the water, you can tell that occasionally it's going to come up underneath the house.
But the porters say it's not the water that worries them.
The real threat to our family's house is not hurricane and flood. It's from the state of Texas.
The porters have been engaged in a decade-long struggle with the state government, and it's a fight that may foreshadow battles in other coastal areas. At issue, what happens when the public beach moves onto private property? You see, in Texas, and to varying degrees in other states, the beach is essentially a park.
You can't go out and build a house on a state park.
And you can't keep a house on a state park, even if the house was there first and the park moved under it, says former state senator Babe Schwartz. He's an author of the Texas Open Beaches Act, a 50-year-old law that declares the beach a public way.
If you've got any piece of your structure on what is state land, then you're not entitled to keep it there.
That's what the state told Brooks Porter and some of his neighbors back in the late 90s. By then, the beach had moved inland onto their lots.
They said, we want you to remove your houses from your lots because of the Open Beach Act.
Brooks Porter said no. He and some neighbors hired a lawyer.
Your Honor, there are three separate motions in behalf of the plaintiffs.
Houston attorney Ted Hertz represented the homeowners at more than a dozen hearings in district court beginning in 2001. He argued that the houses shouldn't have to be removed from the beach because they didn't interfere with the public use of the beach.
The public can still sunbathe around them. The surfers can still surf. No one is adversely affected.
That argument failed. The judge ruled that the homes violated the law and would have to go. Eventually. For the time being, the houses could stay, he said, while the case was on appeal. But the judge barred the homeowners from making any repairs. So when an especially high tide knocked out sewer and water pipes several years ago, Brooks and Mary Porter couldn't reconnect them.
You see, turn it on and nothing happens.
Mary Porter stands by the kitchen sink.
No water coming out of the pipes.
So,
and no sewer.
No using the bathroom.
No using the bathroom. That's
right. That kind of makes the house not very usable.
Makes it difficult for spending the night for just anything.
But the porters remained undeterred. They pressed another argument with the state. They said it's unfair for the government to punish them because the government created this predicament. You see, coastal erosion here and elsewhere is not a purely natural phenomenon. Government projects like dams, jetties, and ship canals can rob the shore of sand. And studies show that's what happened at Surfside.
Hello? Okay, we're going to get this town hall meeting underway.
State officials came to Surfside to address that issue and others in the fall of 2006. Jerry Patterson is Texas Land Commissioner.
You know, there are those who say that this erosion is caused by man-made activity. I don't disagree. There are those that say, well, it's because of global warming. There are those that say all these other reasons. I'm not going to argue against that or in favor of that. But the question is, what do we do today?
Patterson offered a solution. He said the state would try to slow the erosion by putting $1 million worth of sand on the beach. That should help keep more houses from ending up by the water in the future. But as for the homes already on the beach, he said it's too late to save them. In fact, they have to go to make way for the sand.
What I'm telling you is the front row is in the way of anything we can do to preserve the other rows.
Patterson offered a solution there, too. He said the state would pay the cost of moving homes from the beach onto inland lots. More than a dozen homeowners accepted the offer. But 14 houses remain on the beach, and among these holdouts are Brooks and Mary Porter. They say the state's offer was inadequate. The state refused to pay them for their land.
Both the Texas and the United States Constitution spell it out that you cannot take property from individuals or from families without adequate compensation.
The state says it's not taking anyone's property. The Gulf of Mexico is. But this constitutional argument is the basis of the Porter's continuing lawsuit. That lawsuit is headed toward a state appeals court and possibly beyond.
We and some of the other people will fight this, if need be, all the way to the Supreme Court.
And a lot of people will be watching. How this case gets resolved could set a precedent far beyond Texas. What if rising seas threaten one day to swamp skyscrapers in Manhattan or entire towns in Florida? Whose responsibility will it be to move buildings out of the way? Who will take the hit for the lost property value? In Surfside, children still play around the homes on the beach. They scoop sand into buckets. They upend the buckets to build towers. They adorn the towers with shells and feathers.
A sand castle.
Then the tide turns and the castles of sand melt into the sea. For NPR News, I'm David Barron.
And you can see just how close to the edge these homes are in an audio slideshow at our website, npr.org.
Support for the series Shifting Ground comes from the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy.
Well, one thing you can't buy with that rebate check, a break from too much information. This week on Morning Edition, we're focusing on the kind of information overload that comes with emails. But let's say you had to pay to send an email. It's a good bet you'd send only messages that were truly important. And that's the idea of a company called Seriosity. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
There are lots of solutions to email overload now being bandied about. Most are attempts to filter or prioritize stuff once it hits your mailbox. The company Seriosity believes the problem should be addressed at the source, with the sender.
People tend to overuse what's free to them. And right now, email is basically free.
At least free for the sender, says Simon Roy, Seriosity's chief executive. But what's free for the sender, he continues, imposes a sizable burden on the recipient. Seriosity wants to make senders attach virtual money, known as serios, to every email. And as co-founder Byron Reeves explains, the amount of money a sender has is limited.
You get an allowance every week. You can't ask for more. So you have a scarce resource, and you can use that resource to signal importance to the people you communicate with. But you can't send more than you've got. So you have to think a little bit about how you're going to use this signal, how much currency you're going to attach to information.
Let me start a new message to one of the people in the company, Jonathan.
Simon Roy sits at his keyboard and begins to type a message. He's using the email program Outlook, but the screen has one additional column.
I will tab over to the serio control, which gives me the ability to sign the serios, and I very quickly put in 9 serios. I get to see that Jonathan typically receives 5. So this is a reasonably important message for him, and I will send the message as I normally would. That's it.
And here comes perhaps the most important part. Jonathan can immediately recognize the value his boss has assigned to the email, so he knows if it's something he needs to look at right away or something that can safely be ignored. In this case, Jonathan responds immediately, sending a reply loaded with serios to convey that his answer is also very important. But suppose you send your boss a marketing plan you've created. You think it's great and attach a large chunk of your weekly allowance. But when your boss replies, what you get is a curt thank you, along with just 2 serios.
You certainly run the risk of getting feedback you might not like.
Seriosity's co-founder Reeves is a Stanford psychology professor. He says getting feedback from the recipient is very important. Seriosity's premise, which is backed by millions in venture capital, is that people within an organization will quickly learn what is and isn't valued by bosses and colleagues. That should make the number of irrelevant or dumb emails decline, and in theory at least, make communication more focused and productive. Will it work? We asked Thad Lyon, an IT manager at eBay's North Campus in San Jose.
I think everybody liked the idea of actually being able to log into their mailbox and actually having a separate column and quickly being able to view, you know, things that were weighted a little bit higher, right? I know I got that way.
Lion was part of a small test that experimented with an early version of Siriosity's software.
I think that absolutely that had potential for certain segments within eBay to work very well.
Siriosity's product is by no means the only approach eBay is considering, but like so many companies, it has to do something. The cost of information overload and the interruptions that go along with it are staggering. Chipmaker Intel, for example, puts their own cost at $1 billion a year. Once again, Siriosity's Simon Roy.
We don't see the problem, you know, lessening. If anything, it's going to get worse as more and more people come online and they're connected, for longer periods.
Some of the biggest technology firms in the country are now banding together to fight information overload. Just last week, Intel, Google, IBM, Microsoft, and others formed a nonprofit group to study the problem, publicize it, and come up with new solutions. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
And ever hit send and then wish you hadn't? Share your story. We'll post some of them at npr.org.